Hi, I'm Moshe Zeldman. Welcome to Shmoozin. We live in times of unprecedented change and confusion. The rise of cancel culture, the promises and the threats of artificial intelligence, identity politics, a society where more people are more digitally connected but are feeling lonelier than ever, and a world that seems to be edging towards World War III. I believe that Judaism can shed light on all of these issues. Shmoozin is more than a podcast. The platform for a community of thoughtful voices on these important topics. Let's explore together how Judaism can provoke us to deepen our understanding of the times we live in, confront the challenges we face, and bring some light into this world. So one of the things I struggle about with this war, in terms of how it's unfolding in the West, is the question of where people really stand. You, of course, have activists on the side of good. Of course, you have activists on the side of evil, pro-Hamas. And you have a lot of people in the middle who really aren't saying anything. And we've all probably encountered people like that. There are heads of universities who have violent anti-Semitic protests taking place on their campuses and either took a very long time or to this day have still not said anything in condemnation. So I want to talk about the idea of indifference. There's that famous quote, it's attributed to Edmund Burke, but it's apparently not him who said it. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So that's true on many levels. There's a Western indifference to pro-Hamas protests. There's moderate Muslims who are silent, indifferent, scared to stand up and say anything against Hamas and against the atrocity. And maybe even us, maybe even in our day-to-day lives, we could be doing more, speaking up more, advocating more, and we're not. If we look at what happened in pre-war Germany, the Nazis were able to be successful in their goals of wiping out the Jewish people because of a lot of complicity and a lot of willful ignorance on behalf of your average German. So I wanted to reach out and speak to somebody who had knowledge of pre-war Germany and the Holocaust, but from not a Jewish perspective. I found a fascinating person, a nun, who is a Holocaust historian, and she studied the question of indifference. Carol Rittner is an American nun and a Holocaust historian. She is a distinguished emerita professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Stockton University. Dr. Rittner produced a film called The Courage to Care, which was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. The documentary focuses on three Christians who rescued Jews during the Holocaust. And Dr. Rittner is the former director of the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity. Okay, Sister Carol, let's get started. Learn a lot from you in the course of this talk. You told me a little bit about your background, but I'd like to, just for the listeners, if you can explain maybe a little bit, growing up as a Christian and becoming a nun, how do you draw the line between that kind of an upbringing and then eventually ending up doing Holocaust and genocide studies? Probably not where most nuns end up.
That's very true. That's a great question. First of all, I should tell you, I came from sort of normal family, by which I mean I had an older brother, two younger sisters. My father was Protestant Christian. My mother was Roman Catholic Christian, so a mixed marriage. We went to Mass with my mother on Sundays and on the holy days, the holidays of, you know, Christmas, Easter, etc. And I went to public school. In high school, I went to a Catholic high school and in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And then to begin my undergraduate work, I chose to go to a Catholic college, Immaculata College, now Immaculata University, which is outside of Philadelphia. And so I always feel like when people ask me, well, how did you get into this? I always feel like there was in me already, some doubt about this can't be right.
Interesting.
But by the time I read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, and I started to ask myself, well, where were the Christians? Why didn't they help these Jews? And I began to study. I am, if I could put it this way, a self-taught, I hate to say scholar, because that always seems a bit pompous to me, a self-taught scholar of the Holocaust. And I mean, I have a master's, I got a master's in English from the University of Maryland. I went on and got a doctorate in higher education administration, Penn State University. And then I got another master's in theology from St. John's Seminary in Detroit, Michigan. And particularly when I started to study theology, almost every paper I ever wrote had something to do with Jews and with, interpretation of scripture, etc. So Man's Search for Meaning.
That was a real turnaround for you.
Why didn't Christians help Jews? And I began to see that there was an underside to Christian theology that demeaned Jews. And that always the Jews were always getting it stuck to them. And now I think Vatican II, and in the last 50 plus years, I think the Roman Catholic Church and the mainstream Christian churches have tried very hard to correct those teachings. Yeah. And to, unfortunately, I don't think it always filters down as much as I would like it to filter down. But I think, seminary training of priests has changed enormously.
What really motivated you then in terms of studying Holocaust was just, it was bothering you that Christians, Catholics that were otherwise taking their Bible and their religion seriously were somehow ignoring, or maybe even because of those Bible teachings were not going out of their way
Absolutely.
At all to do anything to help Jews in the Holocaust. Interesting.
I mean, that's so in other words,
it would bother you more to see a Catholic not help their Jewish neighbors in the Holocaust than it would somebody who's an atheist or somebody who has no religious affiliation.
It was because I was a professional, I'll put it in quotation marks, a professional Christian. And I'm thinking about and trying to pray about and studying about and reading, we're supposed to help people in need. I mean, if you look at Matthew, one of the questions you asked, I think it's, something in the scriptures. Well, Matthew 25, which is a story in which Jesus is asked a question about who's going to be saved and all of this kind of thing. And the story is, he says, well, at the end of time, when the Son of Man comes, all the people from all the nations will gather before him, and there will be sheep and there will be goats. And he will say to the sheep on his right, come enter into my Father's kingdom, because I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was in prison and you visited me. I was a stranger. You welcomed me. He'll say to the goats who were on his left, depart from me. Because I was hungry and you never helped me. I was sick and you never took care, et cetera. So all of that I'm trying to live out in my life. And I'm like, well, where were the Christians? Why didn't they help these Jews who were obviously in need?
Well, it's interesting because it's a question almost on two levels. It's a question on two levels because there's, let's say, your average Christian who goes to church and who is a religious person who by and large, those people did not help Jews. There's obviously exceptions, there's righteous Gentiles. But then there's also the level of the church policy itself on an official level against helping Jews. So on both levels,
First of all, let me say, Rabbi, it's complex. It's not a simple black and white issue. Uh-huh. And Absolutely. I mean, the too much of the teaching and preaching, you know, where Catholic Christians, Protestant Christians, Orthodox Christians, they preach, and some still do, although I can't say that I've heard these kinds of sermons, that they preach over against the Jews rather than trying to say, look, Jesus was a Jew. He lived out. Right. I mean, he'd be closer to you than he probably would be to me. You know what?
Right.
And what happened in the Catholic Church and in the Christian churches generally after the Reformation, we lost sight of the fact that Jesus was a Jew. You know, we thought he was a Catholic, because only Catholics were going to heaven now, remember, right? outside the church, there is no salvation. Again, I mean, I'm speaking in broad brushstrokes here. You can read the history of this. But there's no doubt in my mind that the kind of teaching and preaching that went on in churches
really lent a hand to the anti-Semitism.
Mean Jews and caused Christians to be, you know, I want to say they weren't sensitive and aware and willing to help. There was a lot, I mean, so, but thank God for Vatican Council II, which at least has tried and is trying to, you know, change people's attitudes.
Well, it's interesting. The thing that I found a lot, and I know you worked with you were the director of the Elie Wiesel Foundation. First director. So a lot of what I see you talk about and write about is not just, you know, the manifest anti-Semitism coming from Catholics in Europe, but also just the idea of the indifference, right? You made this film, The Courage to Care. And I think a lot of the theme that I'm seeing there, and a lot of it's what makes it relevant to me today, that's why I'm interviewing you at this time in Jewish history, is just the indifference, really. I'll just read you a quote I saw from Abraham Joshua Heschel. He says, "Indifference to evil is more insidious than evil itself. It is a silent justification affording evil acceptability in society." In other words, the very fact that people sit back and do nothing, that's what gives space for evil to be able to manifest.
Absolutely.
So just from your studies, what you've seen from your Holocaust studies, have you seen that that's really the case?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it isn't just intellectually knowing. I mean, I think I can make this statement. I forget the exact number of Gentiles have been honored by Yad Vashem as righteous.
Right.
It's like 27,000 or 28,000, something like that. And of course, I always say to students, because they'll say, well, you know, these people helped. And I say, look, 27 or 28,000. I said, multiply it 10 times. Then if you have, you know, what, 2 million, what, 10 times 20, 200 and whatever. If there are 2 million, but think about the overall population of occupied Europe and how many of them were baptized Christians, not just Roman Catholic Christians, but Protestant Christians, Lutherans, right, et cetera. It's a very small number. And I said, but if you look at the people who have been honored by Yad Vashem as righteous Gentiles, they weren't the great intellectuals. They weren't people like me who had the opportunity to get their doctorate. Many of them are just ordinary people who knew the difference between right and wrong.
Right.
And, right, you know, who had models, perhaps in their parents or a neighbor or a significant teacher, or even it could have been a clergy person or a nun who taught them.
Right.
But, you know, so this whole issue of indifference, I think, you know, I mean, as we look at the issue of the Holocaust, even we look at issues today, when parents either are silent when something, I mean, you know, because we're like 24/7 news feed on, you know, whether it's our telephones, our computers, our televisions, whatever right. it is, social media. But if they're quiet about things like things that Trump said about people who are handicapped or disabled, and if parents either laugh at it or laugh at jokes, kids pick that up. And then
they
can remain like...
Well, it's interesting. It makes me feel almost like, you know, I'm looking at now this, you know, the uprising anti-Semitism on the campuses and in, you know, every city I visited on this trip, there's, you know, Jews are scared. Jews are scared because there's masses of people, not just pro-Palestinian, but pro-Hamas and or denying there was an atrocity or saying the Jews deserved it or, you know, we want to slit the throats of more Jews. Horrible things.
I cannot understand that attitude.
So what's interesting to me about it is it's, you know, there's obviously a point where I say we have to do whatever we can as a community to fight that evil. But at the same time, it's almost like part of the battle isn't even the evil. Like evil people are evil people and they're going to continue to be evil. What allows them to succeed is the indifference of the masses. So it's almost like I would rather aim at shaking people up to take a stand who are on the fence, who just don't care and say, whatever, not my problem. Those seem to me to be more that seems to be more where the problem is going to evolve and grow rather than with those themselves who are the ones proactively involved in the cause.
I mean, how do we overcome indifference?
That's really the question.
I think the power of example of people who have something to lose, who stand up and speak out, even if it's, I don't want to say as simple as, because it's not simple, but I mean, the sister I live with just celebrated a birthday last week, and the doorbell rang. It was someone coming to deliver flowers. We have a little sign on our door. It says, "I am a proud Democrat." Pasted on the screen at the storm door at our front door. The guy hands me the flowers and says, "They're for Sister Deirdre." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." He said, "Could I tell you a joke?" And he told me a joke that was very demeaning to President Biden. Well, and I said, "I don't think that's one bit funny." And I didn't slam the door.
He made it clear you weren't happy.
But I think of course that didn't cost me anything. I wasn't standing in front of a big audience, but I just think that we adults, whether we're teachers or clergy or doctors or lawyers or parents or whoever, we have to have the courage. We have to know the difference between right and wrong. We have to know when somebody's being demeaned or telling a joke that demeans somebody. Say that's not right.
So you're raising a really interesting point. The question I was going to ask, and I think you've already answered it beautifully, is I look at what's going on today in the Jewish world, and I say, you know, there's clearly this faction of radical Islam that are doing horrible, horrible things in the name of Islam, and it's hard to find moderate Muslims who stand up against it. At the same time, you have this upsurge of anti-Semitism, and there's many, many good people that have said nothing, presidents of universities that have said nothing, against student groups that are glorifying what Hamas did. So my question was going to be, you know, I understand today for a student to stand up on a campus and say, "I support Israel," is dangerous. And for a Muslim in Saudi Arabia or Qatar to say, "I think Hamas is evil," is also dangerous. So, you know, during the uprising in Iran, the Green Revolution years ago, you know, those protesters who knew that if they get caught, that's it. They're going to be tortured and never see their families again. So I understand that it takes a uniquely brave person to stand up when there's a real risk to life. But to say to somebody like, "Come on, can you write a letter to your senator? Can you join a rally in support of, you know, you'll be one of thousands." And what you're saying really is the answer to indifference doesn't even have to be that I'm going to take the time to write a letter to my senator. Or I'm going to show up to a rally. I'm just, next time I see that thing on the news or next time somebody in my office makes a comment, I'm not going to sit there and say nothing. If I'm offended or I feel they said something wrong, I'm going to say something. And it's right. Those small daily acts of just standing my ground and not hiding what I believe, those daily acts of small courage, you would say, in a sense, is the way of fighting indifference.
Absolutely. But, you know, this we have to teach this to our children. And we do it not just by words, but by example.
By example, exactly.
I agree with you. I've thought a bit about, it's easy enough to say what we ought to do, but I haven't been faced with a life or death situation, but I've thought a little bit about that. And I don't want to die. I'm no youngster, but I still feel like I have life left in me and I'd like to keep on going. But I've thought, I've lived a long life, and if that's what it takes, I'm thinking about what can I do now? I publish a little newsletter. I call it, maybe I told you this when you wrote it, if you wanted to interview me, it's called Mercy Words. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, what can I do in terms of this? I try to do it once a month. It's only 2 pages long. It's electronic. I'll make a few comments. I'll put quotes in from various articles. Like there's a theme that I'm interested in or some issue I want to raise. So the last one, I'll send you a copy when we get off of here. I'm not saying it's brilliant, but I read the first article I read about the sexual abuse on October the 7th and how the media and the UN and women's organizations were not giving attention to it. So my mercy words, I sent it, goes to more than 2,000 people, mostly nuns. I send it mostly, although to lay people get it as well. So I made that issue. I thought I can comment about this and at least raise the question, why isn't the issue of sexual violence against the people in southern Israel, Jews and perhaps non-Jews as well, farm workers,
Could have been,
from Thailand or the Philippines or wherever, why haven't we started to read about this? In fact, the UN had its day of to abolish violence against women. Just on November 25th, I think it was. So anyhow, it's a small thing, and I thought I can do that. I did it. I sent it out. I got some comments. Most comments were, "Thanks very much. I'm going to pass this on to some other people to inform them." So, I said I can, I condemn what Hamas did on October the 7th. It's a terrorist organization. Well, I'll send it to you and you can see it.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
And I gave some resources that people could go to. Now, it's already 10 days old or 8 days old, so there are more resources now that one could go to. But I don't know.
It's interesting because it really leads to, I have another quote you had. It's a quote of Elie Wiesel that you say. He said, "What hurts the victim most is not the cruelty of the oppressor, but the silence of the bystander." So it's, women that were abused. So there's the trauma of abuse, obviously. But then to see, I'm living in a world of women's rights organizations who at the drop of a hat will condemn any kind of abuse towards women. But, because we're Jews or because we're Israelis, so they're not. And that it adds a whole other layer of pain to their trauma.
We have to find ways to combat the rising anti-Semitism. I try to do it by educating, by giving, I organized, helped organize with the local public television station. We actually raised $250,000 to do this, to a program. It's called Holocaust Warnings, American Anti-Semitism and Extremism. And I, wow. I think probably, so there's this hour-long program that was broadcast in September, and they have all these resources and everything. I mean, I'm trying to educate in my, you know, I'm not teaching in a classroom.
No, I can see you're clearly actively still very involved. You're sending messages out to people, and there's no question you're being influential, and you're doing what you can do. It is interesting that I was going to go back to something you said earlier. I've taken five trips to Poland. I brought groups to the camps, Jewish groups to the camps to see what happened and to learn the history. And I think on two of those trips, we met righteous Gentiles. We met women who were older, but at the time of the Holocaust, they were children. And their parents hid Jews in their barn, in their farm, in their basement. And they were little girls. They, you know, they weren't the ones making the decision, obviously, but you know, they were, you know, bringing food down to them. And they knew full well that if the Nazis catch them, they're going to be, you know, treated worse than the Jews and horribly tortured. And in both cases, the question that all the students asked them was, why? Why did you risk your life? Why did you risk your life for people that are total strangers? And it's interesting because in both cases, the answer was, what do you mean, why? Why not? How could you? I'm going to stand by and let these Jews be taken off. They're human beings. They deserve life as much as anybody else. It was almost like they couldn't answer the question because it was so obviously just the right thing to do. And yet they are the small percentage that actually did it. So it must be, as you said before, it's that when you're raised with that set of values, your parents imbibe you with those set of values. It just becomes the obvious moral instinct. It's not that I have to learn about it or logically justify it. It's just instinctively the right thing to do. And I would want somebody to do it for me. So obviously I should do it for them.
Right. I mean, Ellie, you know, one of the things Elie Wiesel used to say was, evil is a mystery. So is goodness.
Interesting.
You know, interesting. I mean, goodness is a mystery. How do you explain it? And yeah. I mean, it is like, again, if I can reference Sister Deirdre, with whom I live, I mean, she is far more outgoing than I am. She is far more like, I learned from her how to be generous because she is so generous to people. And I'm like, no, don't do that. You know, whatever it is. And there is something about some people that it's a mystery. I mean, goodness is a mystery. And, you know, why did the parents or the family of those two women or those two women themselves, why did they help? I mean, I you know, they just knew the difference between right and wrong. And this is a person and...
Right. Yeah, that's what it is. Calling it a mystery is the best way to say it. It's just either you get it or you don't.
Right. When you read these stories about these people, you know, you just... It's like, how did they become the kind of people they became? You know, right. We can answer ourselves that question about ourselves. When I say to myself, how have I become the kind of person I have become? I'm certainly not a perfect person by any means, but why do I have the values that I have? I mean, honestly, I came from an ordinary family. As I said to you earlier, you know, We had Jewish friends. My father had Jewish business associates and customers and all the rest of that. So I didn't hear things, you know, like I didn't hear Jews demeaned, but right. I did hear Black people demeaned. And, you know, I didn't come from a perfect family. So, you know, and I, even as an adult, as a woman, I'm 80 years old. And I mean, even at my age, I have to catch myself that I don't in terms of whatever prejudices I may have, whether right. about whatever, let's say about that, I have to catch myself and say, stop, you know, either keep quiet, hearings, example, you know, educate, things that we read. I often think about the books that I've read. And, you know, what we read certainly has an influence. I mean, certainly Elie Wiesel was a major influence on me. Sure. I haven't read all of Abraham Joshua Heschel, but, you know, I mean, I've read a fair amount of, you know, some of his essays. I mean, they're beautiful and they're challenging and they make me think. I also think that, you know, some of this, why do people stand by and... you know, I think people are thoughtless. They don't think and reflect. I mean, I'm not saying I'm a great empathetic person. I'm probably not. But I mean, I think as I've gotten older and tried to reflect on things and, you know.
Well, look, some people just have it more naturally and some don't. Like you said, you know, that baker in Poland who risked his life to save Jews might not have been the most spiritually, emotionally sensitive person who spent days and days or years working on themselves. It's just somebody who had an instinct. So I think we all have, like you said earlier. Well, what's interesting is what you're pointing out is, and it's, I think it is, it's true, but it's not obvious to us all the time that being highly educated or even being of very high intelligence has nothing to do with the person's level of morality. So you see it on the one hand with righteous Gentiles, simple people that really were unbelievable moral heroes. And at the opposite extreme, you have highly educated Harvard Ivy League students who know nothing.
Think about the Einsatzgruppen, the heads of the Einsatzgruppen. Right. I forget the exact number. I forget.
There was a number of PhDs.
A number of them had PhDs. And one, I mean, take Jan Karski. Jan Karski has been honored by Yad Vashem. And mm-hmm. Karski was the Polish diplomat. He taught at Georgetown after the war.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if he had a doctorate or not. But, of course, there were diplomats who have been honored as righteous. And there were... some university, and there even were priests and nuns and clergy persons who have Protestant clergy who have been honored as right. It's a mystery. Goodness is a mystery, Rabbi. I mean, as Elie Wiesel said, but I think this question of how do we become the kind of people we become? Why do we make the choices we make? And even when we recognize some of our choices are not right, what is it that enables us to like reverse course and say, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to,
right.
I mean, human
and
beings.
The truth is none of us can ever say with certainty what we would do if we were in that situation. We really just don't know.
I absolutely. I mean, you know, I have had, of course, you know, students ask me, undergrad, even graduate students, well, what would you do? And I always say, look, I don't know. I could tell you what I hope I would do.
Exactly. So I don't want to take too much of your time. I do want to get to a couple more questions.
Okay.
Given your knowledge of, I guess, of Germany and of pre-war Europe and the rise of anti-Semitism that led to it, how would you compare what's going on in America now with the rise in anti-Semitism to what was going on in pre-war Germany and Europe? Oh, I'll tell you, there's many Jews that are...
Question, Rabbi, come on. That's a huge question. Here's what I would say. I would say that anti-Semitism in pre-war Europe, Germany, the centuries leading up to it, was awful and horrible. And Jews, I mean, they were put in ghettos. They were discriminated against. They were thrown out of countries. They were murdered. The whole thing. But they didn't have social media. I think today that social media is so pernicious and so vile. You know, we thought it would be something for good, but too many people have used it to spread hatred and lies about mm-hmm. Jews. And And also about Islam. I mean, as we both would say,
sure,
every Muslim is not a Jew hater, you know, right. And so we shouldn't lump everyone together. Every Christian is not a hate, it's not an anti-Semite. But I think so. What pre-war, the years, the centuries and years leading up to it, and even until we didn't have social media. But now, I think the power, well, we know. Look, just look at that guy who, what's his name? Elon Musk. But I mean, it's very interesting that he has such power in terms of that X, which was Twitter, that he's meeting with the Prime Minister of Israel.
Right, right. No, he's become very influential by virtue of his money.
And by virtue of owning that terrible...
Right, yeah, but that money lets him own... Right, right. So what I understand you to say, you're saying that... Well, you're saying really it's hard to make the comparison, but what is going now is clearly dangerous. You know, one of the most common things I hear from my Jewish friends, and I'm visiting LA right now, and you know, there's been a lot of pro-Hamas protests in Jewish areas of Los Angeles, and I hear Jews here who are very comfortable and very settled. They've been living here, you know, their whole lives, who are saying, you know, for the first time, I understand what it was like for Jews in Germany. You look at Jews right. in Germany in the 1930s, and you say, like, didn't they see the writing on the wall? Didn't they see, like, why didn't they get out when they could? Why didn't they get out before it got too difficult? And they're looking at themselves and saying, you know, maybe now I get it. We could hop on a plane and go to Israel, but it's hard and relocating and a new language and a new culture and my job and my kids and my family. And so I understand the dilemma, but it's Jews, many Jews for the first time feeling like maybe this is kind of like 1930s in Germany. It certainly feels like that at many times.
Well, I think that we who are not Jewish need to, in small ways and large ways, stand in solidarity with our Jewish friends and neighbors and colleagues and, you know, do what we can to, I know words and gestures are cheap, but it's all that we can do is to...
No, like words or gestures, when it's millions of people doing them, they make a difference.
Right, exactly, exactly.
So, okay, so two more last questions if I can ask you. I really appreciate you giving me all this time. And I want to ask you this question as a nun and as somebody who's immersed in Christianity. I think you would probably say your moral values and your moral imperatives are guided by your studies, by understanding the Bible. If you were talking to somebody who wasn't religious, let's say somebody who was even an atheist, and they said, you know, I don't care about people. You know, if I see somebody drowning, it's their problem. Why am I obligated? Oh my God. What obligates me to help somebody else? If I don't bring God into the picture, where does that moral imperative come from your perspective, to feel a moral obligation? You know, a person say, listen, I'm a good person. I don't hurt people. Do I have to go out of my way to help people in need? Who says? I mind my business. I live my life. They live theirs. Why should I get involved?
Oh, my God. That it's a perplexing question to me. if a person cannot look at another person and see himself or herself somehow in that other person, I have to say I feel speechless. What would you say?
What I would say, and I don't know if it would actually work, but I would think to say is, you know, imagine the shoe was on the other foot. You're drowning, and there's somebody walking by that could throw you a life raft or call 911 or jump in the water and save you. Isn't it obvious, too, that they should do that? Wouldn't you want them to do it? So why should you see yourself as any different than them when you're in that position? If you have an opportunity to save somebody, especially if, you know, we're not saying give up your life. We're not saying take a bullet for them. just jump in the water. Just, you know, give a little extra donation to help people in trouble. Not because I can prove to you logically that you need to, but because it's obvious that you would want it done to you if you were on the if you were on the needy end.
Do to others what you want done to you.
Yeah. I think that's really what it comes down to.
You know that question that you asked me now, this is going to trouble me. you're going to be part of my prayer.
I spend a lot, as a rabbi, I actually spend a lot of my time talking to people who aren't religious. They don't really follow any Jewish practices. One of them doesn't believe in God at all, even though they were born Jewish. And it was just really interesting to try and convince them, like, you know, there's a thing called morality, whether you believe in God or not. There's sometimes it's just simply the right thing to do. Can I prove it to you logically? No, you have to have an intuitive sense of just knowing that, you know, killing innocent people is wrong. And letting innocent people die is wrong if you can do something about it. And if you don't get that, I feel sorry for you. You're missing some of your humanity.
I guess it could be reduced to do to other people what you want done to you. And, you know, whether it's supporting a university, supporting the local orchestra, supporting a food bank, helping somebody get through university or through the medical school, they have this sense of obligation to give back.
And in this case, this idea of do unto others would also be in the case.
Go ahead.
Okay. Sister Carol, one final question for you. First of all, thank you again for the time. I really appreciate it. It's been very enlightening. I really enjoyed the conversation. Here we go. The question is, if you had to sum up your years of thought and research on the topic of hatred, genocide, and indifference, what would be your takeaway message to our listeners who are confronted with this war against evil and in a society that's apathetic to evil and sometimes even sympathetic to evil? What would be the takeaway?
You can't do everything. You can't do everything. But you can do something. One of my favorite stories was the story of the little Dutch boy who's walking along the dike and he sees a hole in the dike and water is coming through the hole and he knows that the dike could be washed away. So he puts his finger in the hole to keep the water from coming through the hole until someone comes along and they can repair the dike. That's what we have to do. Put our finger in the hole. Can't do everything, but we can do something. And I think I would say, do to other people and treat other people the way you want to be treated. And don't give up. Just keep at it.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
To me, there was a couple of interesting things that came out of my discussion with Sister Rittner. One is that when we talk about being active and advocating, it's not just a question of, am I going to sign a petition or write a letter to my local politician or attending a rally or a protest. It's the idea that on a day-to-day level, there are things I could be doing to influence people around me. Even just how I react, how my kids or my neighbors or my friends see me react to things that are going on in the world around us. There's always going to be actors of evil. For us, any small act that fights that evil, any small act of protest multiplied by the millions of us that could be doing it, becomes a wave of change. A tidal wave is made up of many, many drops of water. And all it takes is for every one of us every day to look for places and for times we could be making that influence just by a simple comment or a pushback to somebody else who makes a comment. The second interesting idea is just the question of being active altogether. There's an idea in tort law called duty to rescue. According to common law, a bystander is not under any moral obligation to help if they didn't cause the person's injury. It means that if you're standing by and see somebody who is drowning, you're not under any obligation to save them. You might say there's a moral obligation. You might say that you feel the obligation to save them. But in terms of how Western secular law deals with it, you have no moral obligation to help anybody who's in trouble if you didn't cause that trouble. What's interesting is the Torah says the exact opposite. From a Torah perspective, there's commandments to return lost objects. You're not allowed to ignore a lost object that you see. You're obligated to take responsibility for it and return it. More strongly than that, the Torah says, Lo ta'amod al dam re'acha. If you see somebody whose life is in danger, you're obligated to save them. It's not the same as murder, but it's akin to murder for you to not do your part in doing what you can to save somebody whose life is in danger. You have the statement in the Ethics of the Fathers, one of the books of the Talmud, Pirkei Avot. In a place where there's no men, be a man. In other words, in a place where nobody's exhibiting leadership and things need to get done, you have an obligation to stand up and do what you can. So yes, we can point the finger at moderate Muslims who aren't standing up to Hamas because you get your head chopped off. We can point our fingers also at people who have responsibilities in our society, university professors, politicians, heads of organizations, who could and should say something and don't. And we can also point the finger inward at ourselves and ask the question, am I doing as much as I can in my own daily way to register small acts of protest to the violence and the evil that I see around me? Thank you for listening. Please like, subscribe, and also leave feedback if you liked the content, and especially if you didn't. These are important conversations, so let's keep schmoozing.